sustainable, earth-friendly practices. I interview backyard gardeners, market farmers, and people who have green businesses related to food. I'd love it if you'd join us on the Progressive Radio Network, coming on Monday evenings at 7 p.m.
Stay tuned for the best information on health and nutrition, current events, economics, the environment, and more on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. Peter R. Breggin, MD, is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Well, hello, my wonderful, wonderful audience. The world has never needed you more, and I've never needed you more. And as always, I'm so glad to be on the air talking to you. In fact, I've gone ahead today and decided to do a live show for a number of reasons, even though I'm in a hotel room in Indiana. But I've set up well. I hope the sound is good on this phone, and I'm instant messaging with the engineer at PRN, and I got my guest online. Carolyn, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Peter.
Oh, my God. Well, Carolyn is there, so, and this is going to be a very, very interesting show with Carolyn Leaf. I'll tell you about her in a moment. Last week, when I got on the air, I had literally just finished watching the live Dr. Oz show, which was supposed to be using me and a couple of other critics to start the show out to talk about that psychiatric drugs can cause violence and related to the mass shootings. Well, the show panel, I should have known when I wasn't on the panel live, the show panel was a group of people with avowed interests in the pharmaceutical industry, and who actually knew almost nothing about the adverse effects of psychiatric drugs, as far as I could tell, and certainly had no direct experience with the school shooting, so, or with mass murder. So it was a set-up show, and it was just terrible, and you could tell it from hearing me talk, the distress I was in. But since then, I've concluded that that show was a total victory. And one of the indications of just how powerful it must have seemed to the pharmaceutical industry, that when Dr. Oz put the show up on his website within, I think, 10, 12 hours or so, I was removed. So the show now, as it airs on the archive, doesn't even have me in it. And then, now, why would you go to that extreme? Obviously, this show did not turn out the way he wanted. And I think it was partly due to his own ambivalence. So I wrote a recent blog about it since the show, talking about why I think it actually turned out well. The very idea of the celebrity doctor raising on television with the title of his show, is there a connection between psychiatric drugs and violence, I think was a major breakthrough. And I did get, people did see my name and a couple of other critics on the live. And I think overall it really worked out well. And as I write in my blog, there were just a couple of split seconds where Dr. Oz's brain and heart got bigger than his wallet, and he kind of let out some true feelings. On one occasion, he held up a list of the school shootings that he had put together. He didn't say I'd put it together. He had put together, and I sent him a ton of material, but he'd put together just from newspaper reports, and he sort of held up this scroll list. And he said, I've highlighted the ones that where we know just from the newspapers that psychiatric drugs, psychiatry were somehow involved. And it was at least half of them were highlighted. And you know, that's just not a good thing from the pharmaceutical industry viewpoint. So I'm thinking that it was a success. Now, don't forget, you can get my blogs. You can be aware of them. You can follow everything I'm doing for free on Bregan.com by going there and looking up the frequent alerts, and they're free, and you can go to them. And for those of you interested in antidepressants, I've been updating my 123antidepressants.com. It's a part of my website, but I wanted to make it so simple for people to just go and get papers and research that I've given it a separate link, which is just 123antidepressants.com. So that's there. I've been updating it. I do that as I work on legal cases or as I write an article or a blog and I get some new research. So, and on there, you can look up really fine-tuned material. If you want to be a medical expert or are a medical expert, well, you've got everything you need there on antidepressants.com. And it's divided up in categories for you, so you can look up violence adults, violence children, and even violence animals. You could, and I've got several there, from fish to cats. So there's just all kinds of things that you can find on it with, it must be hundreds of articles by now. So the website keeps growing, the numbers coming through keep growing, and I am just so glad to get on the radio every week and have what's essentially an international conference with all of you, and then to have even greater numbers coming through on the archive. So thank you so much for that. And I'm going to take a deep breath now, and I'm going to introduce you to someone who you may not be familiar with, but I'm getting to know real well, and I'm planning to do some wonderful activities with her. Her name is Dr. Carolyn Leaf, L-E-A-F, Leaf. Carolyn is from South Africa originally, and we may get to talk about some of the amazing things she did during apartheid there, going into areas that other white people did not go into, were not allowed to go into, to actually, you know, bring good services into those really at the time, and I'm sure they're not hugely better. Maybe she can tell us about that, areas of South Africa. She has a PhD in communication pathology, and she's got a Bachelor of Science in, related to audiology. And she's developed these specialized interests in cognitive neuropsychology and metacognitive and cognitive neuropsychology. What she's trying to do, among other things, is bring a healthy antidote to the bizarre theories that try to make us look like we're machines without free will, the biochemical imbalance theory. What she's done, and she's done it in a very effective, popular manner in some really good books. I've been reading her books. My mother-in-law, Jean, who's really a very intelligent and astute human being. Why I'm in Indiana is she's been living with us for 3 months now, and now we're in Indiana picking with her and Ginger and a bunch of friends surrounding her. We're picking up her furnishings and whatever else she wants to bring from Indiana to our new home in Ithaca, New York. But the Jean likes Carolyn Leaf's books. Now, Carolyn brings together, depending on which book or what article she's writing, she brings together a good scientific foundation, and in some of her books, with a really good Judeo-Christian orientation. And she's doing a lot of work in churches, and she's invited me to get involved in that work. And those of you who know me, I've said for decades that the ministers and priests and rabbis really needed to get straight, that they shouldn't be sending people who are in despair to psychiatrists. They should be fined for drugs. They should be developing their own services, therapeutic, psychological services, or finding therapists who understand the Christian or Jewish viewpoint or a Muslim viewpoint or a Buddhist viewpoint, and make that an integral part of the therapy. So I deeply believe in that, and you've heard me talk about that before here on my shows and in my books and in my conferences. Well, Carolyn Leaf is actually a person who is going to be helping me spread that word throughout the country even more, and throughout the world even more. And we have a huge communality of things. And wow, I want to just introduce you to her. Folks, here is Carolyn Leaf. Say hi to our group, Carolyn.
Hi, Dr. Peter Bregan and all your listeners. I'm so thrilled to be here.
Carolyn, I can't hear you on my connectivity. It's very weak. Can you do anything about that? Maybe they can do something about that in the studio.
I'm still on the same line. Can you hear me now? You've gone very quiet.
No, you're very weak. But it may be just in my phone. Let me send a little message.
Very quiet.
To the engineer to check your volume, because I'm not getting much.
Okay, let me see what I can do.
No, not much. Folks, hang in with us while we try to figure out what's happening. I'm at a phone line, just so you all know what's going on. I'm at a phone at a hotel. In my room. You're hearing me good, Carolyn?
I'm hearing you, but you suddenly went very quiet as well. So
very quiet as well.
Yeah, so I can hear you, but it's quiet.
I've gotten a message. We're working on it. It will get better shortly.
Oh, good.
So,
okay,
folks,
so it's not
hang in there.
It's from,
and rather than start with Carolyn at this point, I'm hoping that I'm coming through with my booming voice while they work on it.
Yes, I can hear you.
And, folks, a big, big issue for us in this world today is to help people understand that the brain is not a machine. It's not a computer. It's beyond anything we can conceive of in the way it works, the way it operates. We don't have an Einstein of the brain. We don't even have a Newton of the brain. I don't even think we have a Copernicus of the brain, because it's so far beyond our understanding. And that's been abused by the psychiatric pharmaceutical industry in order to convince people that their science is real when it's nonsense. There are no connections that we know of between neurotransmitter deficiency or problems or any other brain issues in relationship to human problems like being depressed or being manic or being anxious or having OCD or having post-traumatic stress or whatever. Now, some pathologies do exist in the brain. If you drug somebody, you can drive them into depression. If you drug somebody, you can drive them into mania. If you damage the basal ganglia, you can create OCD. But that's different than what people bring to us in our offices. The suffering that human beings routinely have is not caused by that kind of process. We have no evidence that it is. So I'm hoping you're hearing me out there in the wonderful world. Let me know. I don't know how you're going to let me know until later on. If this doesn't turn out well, I'm just going to have Carolyn on as soon as possible again. The engineers, I haven't heard from them again. Maybe they could send me a message that I'm coming through. Carolyn, have I changed in any way with you?
Can you hear me? No, your volume's still quiet, but I can hear you perfectly. Can you hear me?
No, I can't hear you at all. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. I can barely hear you, so I think I will continue
to
talk a little bit.
I'm going to try disconnecting and phoning in again.
I actually can't even hear what you're saying. I just hear that lovely accent and a few words. I'm not getting a clear message from you. But you are hearing me? Hello? I don't know if I've lost completely my phone connection at this point. We're getting her back. Okay. Can people hear me, engineers? Can people hear me? See, I don't have two hands free in order to easily send a message. Okay. I can be heard. So I'm just going to continue, and I'm going to talk more about Carolyn and why I'm so glad to be relating to her. Carolyn's Facebook, folks, has 350,000 people. Now, there's somebody who knows how to communicate, someone from whom I can learn about how to communicate. Carolyn?
I'm here. I'm back.
Oh, and I can hear you. And they're telling me it should be good now. So at least you know, folks, it wasn't Carolyn and it wasn't me, and maybe it wasn't even PRN. I don't know what the cause was. So I'm going to, Carolyn, I've been talking about you and about these issues of neuroscience and free will entirely. So I'm sticking right with you. I'm going to take a deep breath and let you talk now.
You did a great job there. I was actually listening to you, and as you know, you and I have had quite a few conversations, and I've been following you for years, and just you're a hero in my eyes. The other day I called you the Godfather. Do you remember that?
I do. Yes.
When it comes to psychiatry and medication and just understanding the importance of humanity. And anyway, I started my work 30 years ago and in South Africa, and I'm currently working a lot in churches, and I do a lot of, I also work trained doctors and I work with educators, and I work with pretty much everyone. I have a fairly global platform, and my main message is teaching people to move away from neurocentricity. And in simple terms, I basically show people that the mind can change the brain, that the mind is not the brain, that they're separate. And that I find is very news for people. Most people, when you say mind or brain, they think it's the same thing. And that has been a big part of my work, is showing the mind-brain connection and then studying memory, because as we know, if we don't have memory, we don't have anything. And there's been so many misconceptions about memory. So I've been working on memory theory for the last almost 30 years now. And what's amazing about this is that just recently over the weekend, I read a paper about saying that the way that we all see and understand memory has actually got to change. It's wrong. It's not right. And what they propose as the alternative is what I've been proposing for 20 years. So I was very excited about that. And it's very much around us as humans realizing the power of our mind and the power to construct memory and to deal with toxic memories from the past, traumas and that kind of thing. And it gives us tremendous hope. And essentially that's what I've been working on. For many years, I had a practice for 25 years. And I worked with a large group of patients, people with learning disabilities and traumatic brain injuries and learning disabilities, Alzheimer's, depression, emotional issues, autism, pretty much anything that where people had a communication breakdown. And then I would track that back to their thought life and to the brain and to try and help people that they could change their brain. I worked a lot with traumatic brain injury and CTE, all those kind of things where people are not functioning like they should, as I mentioned, and trying to help them track back. And in the process of working with people with communication disorders and brain issues and emotional issues and so on, I very soon learned that the science of thought is where it's at. I needed to really understand thinking and the power of the thought life and the power of a person's story, and even more so is understanding how to really listen to a person and love a person and operate in that kind of environment. Because I was trained in that, in the era in the 80s when they told us that, you know, your brain can't change, and once it's damaged, that's it. Teach your patient compensation, not restoration of function. And it just flew in the face of logic, flew in the face of the good science that was around at the time. And I started doing research on neuroplasticity right back then. And I remember my professors telling me that this is crazy, that it's ridiculous. Why am I trying to show that if someone's had a traumatic brain injury or they've had some major emotional problem or they've got a label of autism or something, why are you trying to change their brain? Just teach them to compensate. And I didn't give up there, and thank goodness I didn't, because I started really working on deliberately and intentionally teaching my patients how to work with their mind, how to be very deliberate and organized and disciplined. And I started studying quantum physics and psychoneuroimmunology and all these different things, epigenetics, everything I could get my hands on to understand how to help people to change their brain. And out of that, I basically developed a whole lot of techniques that I applied and used in research. And then it became, I've always been a Christian, and I believe in God, I believe in love, I believe in the power of spirituality. And I also believe in the research that shows that when we operate in love, we really can change the way, in a quantum instant, how our brain functions and how every cell of our body functions. And that's what I started applying in my therapy practice. And then I started writing a lot of books, and I've written almost 20 books now. And started reaching, doing TV work about 20 years ago. And what happened was it was a way of getting this message out to a lot of people. And for the last 10 years since I've been in the States, I've been doing a lot of work in churches. I do conferences. I do women's conferences, men's conferences. I do my own conferences in churches. And I also talk a lot on Sundays in the Sunday services, where I teach on the spiritual link in science, and show that science and spirituality are not incompatible. And essentially that, you know, spirituality tells us the story, like the Bible and so on, tell us the story of humanity, and science shows us the how of humanity. And then I love quantum physics. It shows us that we pretty much are embedded in love, and we are love, and we're made of love. If you go right down to the quantum level, you know, and this is all scientific. It's not anything weird or woo-woo. This is hardcore science, and it shows that the spiritual nature of man is actually very scientific. And when you show a person, and this has been my experience, because I have really worked for a lot, honestly, 25 years working directly with patients and with people specifically in impoverished environments, with people that have been through tremendous emotional trauma and, you know, raped, abused, AIDS victims in the apartheid era. And just in general, in my practice, I really worked with the worst of the worst, being a therapist didn't want to work with them anymore, they would land up in my practice. The really difficult adolescents, the really difficult cases that people didn't want to work with. And the reason I chose to work with that was because I believed in hope. I believed in the plasticity of the brain. And the research that I did in the 80s with traumatic brain injury showed that when you use your mind, you can actually change your behaviors and subsequently change your brain. So you change your mind, you change your brain, and whatever thoughts you build into your brain are going to produce the behaviors, whatever you say and whatever you do. So if you change your mind, you can change your life. And I showed this. I showed this on an academic level, a cognitive level, emotional level. I showed improvements of up to 35 to 75%, statistically significant improvements in functioning in all these areas. And it was astounding. I didn't even expect that. And I saw, you know, my patients taught me so much, because, and you know this yourself, if you're a therapist, you know that you learn more from your patients than what they learn from you. And I just saw when people are deliberately and intentionally determined to choose to persevere, things happen, things change. And so that's what I've captured into techniques and books. And I teach that in as general lifestyle principles in churches. I teach it in, I train doctors. I work with individuals. I don't work with individuals anymore, but I do on my, I have a TV show. Wherever I can get this message out, I'm teaching people about this message of hope, that you are so powerful, that you're not a label, that you mustn't be limited by a label, that the mind is not the body. We can't apply a biomedical model to a mind issue. And that when those, as you and I both know, all the labels of, you know, the psychiatric labels are so damaging, because they limit people. And you give someone a label, you're immediately going to start, they're going to start living into that label, because whatever you think about the most is actually going to grow in your brain. And once it grows into your brain, it becomes the roots of your thoughts and your actions. So that's really a very, very huge part of what I do, is helping people to not get themselves labeled, to go beyond that, and to give them guidelines on how to move forward with this mind-brain connection. I don't know if that gives you... That's a start.
Well, folks who know me will know that a lot of what you're saying is what my work has been about. I've worked with electroshock patients, and I've worked with people with brain injuries. I have people like that always in my practice. And that people can... just make remarkable progress with the recovery from various kinds of injuries. I think that's an important lesson. I think the other lesson that you're giving is to reverse the idea that your brain makes you this way or that way, and to rather say, no, your mental efforts, your spiritual efforts can make your brain operate in new ways. If you're injured, that can take over and allow you to develop new ways of using your brain. Literally, you develop new ways of using your brain. excuse me. And that is a very encouraging and very true. Now, I think that some of this, our audience, will be skeptical when we leap into the idea of, say, quantum physics. So I want to approach that from two different ways. One, even if it's a metaphor, which Carolyn does not think it is a metaphor, even if it's a metaphor, I think it's a positive and good one. And I don't think I've done enough of what Carolyn is doing in terms of, you know, just reversing this whole process that psychiatry and neurology and really drug company driven research has tried to do, which is we begin with the brain and that's who you are. So I think that what she's doing is really good, but I've always been skeptical about applying concepts like quantum physics even to free will, which is what I think you're going with it. And I'd like to hear more from you, Carolyn, about that. Where are you going with quantum theory?
Okay, so maybe I should start at the beginning. I developed a theory almost 29 years ago that I call the geodesic information processing theory. It's a big mouthful, but basically I show the causal impact of our mind on the physical structure of our brain and our body. And I propose that. Now, back, as you know, obviously science is always developing, and I did a lot of work on the non-conscious mind. And back in the 80s, the non-conscious mind was, I'm sure you're aware of this, Peter. I always feel like when I'm telling you these things, you know this. But just for argument's sake and for the audience's sake, then back in the 80s, the non-conscious mind was seen as just almost like a filing cabinet where it was just a storage facility and maybe a bit of a tape recorder replaying things. But that actually, if you really dig deep into the research, it really wasn't what was really going on. And I think the groundbreaking research was Benjamin Beebe, he was studying around about the same time as I was. And he did that whole experiment showing that just before someone consciously makes a decision, there's a lot of non-conscious action. And a lot of scientists use that, and still today we use that reference work and use that to say that we don't have free will and that we pre-programmed robots and that this action in the brain is just this genetic programming that's playing out. And I don't believe that that's what it is. And a whole lot of other scientists also didn't agree. And there was a lot of debates and arguments, which does happen in science. And it's a very good thing because otherwise you wouldn't learn. But essentially the other side of the coin, which is the one I adopted, was that we are extremely intelligent. We have this incredible ability to process information at incredibly high speeds on an unconscious level. And the unconscious level is not a programmed machine. It is a very highly developed part of us. It's part of our spiritual nature. If you think of our mind has got the conscious element when we're awake, conscious now, listening to each other and so on. But it's driven by the non-conscious mind. And so, that's a simple version of kind of where I started. So I believe that the non-conscious mind, from the research I've done, is operational 24/7, and it works at very, very, very high speeds. And if you look at some of the research in this area, we're looking at speeds of 10 to the 27. And now when we're looking at those kind of speeds, we're looking at quantum speeds. And when we talk about quantum, we're talking about energy. And actually, if you dive into quantum physics, you'll see it's the most accurate of all sciences and fundamental to all sciences. And it's developed so much that in the 20th century, and it's now considered, as I've just mentioned, to be one of the most fundamental sciences in showing a few very interesting principles that totally relate to what you teach, Peter, in terms of operating in getting people to really take responsibility for their lives. Because at the core of quantum physics philosophy is that the human and with their power to think and feel and choose is the kind of like the pinnacle of quantum physics. Without humans' ability to choose, nothing would happen. Because as a person chooses, they basically impact, they cause physical structural change in their brain and in the world. So there's a physical change as a result of the thinking. And quantum physics builds this bridge. I propose this in my theory. I propose that you've got the non-conscious mind where all your existing memories and action is actually happening. Your conscious mind, which is your very deliberate awareness, which is awake when you're awake. But your non-conscious is always operating. And then you've got what you say and what you do. So you've got to have and then you've got the physical effects in the brain. And what quantum physics does is provides us with very solid research showing the causal impact of our thinking. So you started the discussion when we lost volume. I overheard you talking and you so very, you brilliantly, you explained about how the current model is very much focused on, you know, your brain makes you do it. And that neurocentric approach is very much a classical physics approach, where the approach is very much on what you can see and touch and feel is important and what you can't see is not important. And classical physicists will talk about the mind as being an artifact of the brain, or like the result of the neurons firing sufficiently and getting enough energy that, boom, suddenly you've got this spark of energy in its mind. And as Dawkins says, we dance to our DNA. You know, so the materialistic or very neurocentric approach is that the brain is where it's at and the mind is something that we can't see, so it's not actually important. And in fact, they talk about it as promissory materialism. So one day maybe we can explain what we can't see, but until then it's not important. And then they use it to explain away free will, and they use it to explain away all kinds of things. And I always find that very ironic, because they are using their ability to choose to say that. So they use their free will to say there is no free will. So I always find that very interesting when scientists do that kind of thing. So basically, I see quantum, and that's just quantum physics is, it shows another law, another thing why I think quantum physics is a very, very good way of helping us to understand the power of our mind. Is that we have one of the primary laws in quantum physics is entanglement, and entanglement means relationship. And any particles that are in a relationship, you can separate them by thousands of millions of miles, and they will still be connected. There's this, what Einstein used to refer to as spooky action at a distance. And there's subsequently been so much research showing how we impact each other. Now go away from quantum physics for a moment and just think of your gut instinct. When you love someone, you can sense when something's not right. You can be, you know, you can be 1,000 miles away from them, and you just know from that you just sense that something's not right, or you just when your loved one walks in the room, or someone you care for, and they don't say anything, but you just know something's wrong. That connection that we have with people that we're in relationship with, quantum physics explains that, and it gives us a very nice scientific way of talking about how we as humans function, besides using the pure electromagnetics of classical physics, which is very important, but it's only one part of the picture. So I try and dig deeper. So when you get into the non-conscious mind, you have to get into a scientific level. So I use quantum physics and neurophysiology to try and look at that angle. And then I bring those down to techniques and the causal efficacy of our mind. So when we choose, we build thoughts. When we choose, there's so much research showing that as you're thinking, which is your mind in action, you're going to affect your DNA. You're going to affect how your genes are expressing. And there's so much research now showing that this impact of how, as you're thinking, your DNA will change. Your genes will express. You'll actually physically grow thoughts. And the way that you think will affect the folding of the proteins. I mean, it's really a huge field now, a huge awareness of that psycho-neuroimmunology. In other words, the impact of our mind on our health, impact of our mind on our physical functioning, impact on our mind on our emotions, impact on our emotions on our emotions. So that's really a broad overview of how I approach it.
Well, that was a tour de force, and I think, folks, that this is all really, really important. It's becoming clearer and clearer that mind is over matter. And I like what you were saying about how human beings think, and out of that comes changes in the physical universe. And to imagine that it's the reverse, which is basically materialism, and to some extent it's Marxism, too, and it's definitely B.F. Skinner. So let me take a minute with that, because this is important. B.F. Skinner was the darling of the intellectuals back in, I don't know, 50s and 60s. And he was America's greatest psychologist. And he basically, you know, said there is no ghost in the machine. There's nobody inside the black box. That human beings are nothing more than their genetic potentials and their environmental inputs, and there is no free will. And this was just accepted and lauded in academia in a much more direct way than now, when it's more subtly introduced. And I had a chance to meet Skinner. We were both testifying at hearings that my work created on psychosurgery, and somehow Kennedy pulled in Skinner to bolster the science people, that is, the psychosurgeons that I was there testifying against. And the way that worked out was to, you know, to say there's a real science about life, and you know, don't deny the science. And the science is psychosurgery, and the science is behaviorism. And this was the Kennedy hearings. And I called, and Skinner actually connected himself to Marxism, because he said that, well, the one thing that can be said about the Chinese is they get their children to behave more than we get our children to behave the way we want. That's very contradictory, because it sounds like, you know, there's a moral judgment going on there when there isn't supposed to be any effect of morality. So I wrote Skinner a brief note since we had met, and I said, well, how can you feel proud of yourself for your work if you don't believe that you actually are a free will entity, a volitional entity that did your work? And he wrote back a two-sentence letter, which, God, I hope I'll find sometime with my files. This is back in the early 70s. He wrote back and said, I'm not proud. And if you look at the materialism of the Marxist viewpoint, it's that people are not affecting the universe, the industrial processes, somehow the evolution of industrial processes, as if they're not driven by human beings, drives human beings. And, you know, this is a very dismal view of life, and it has led to horrible things in psychology and psychiatry, and to horrible things in politics. And we got to recognize, in order to even understand life, that we human beings make decisions that do instantly change how we feel, how we're going to think in the next instance, how our bodies are going to react. And I love what Carolyn said about, you know, the instant changes surrounding when you have loving feelings. And if you think about your life and you think about a loving experience, or you, in the heat of anger or frustration, you've let yourself let go of all that and feel lovingly toward the person you're with, your entire sense of self will change. Your physical processes will change. The adrenaline will calm down. The brain waves will change. The gut will change. And as we're learning more and more, probably the immune system's going to change. So all of this is very, very important. And as I said, I've been cautious about making those kind of leaps. I really wanted to separate the spiritual and the material in a different way than Carolyn is. But I think she's on the right track, and I think it's really important to be working in this area. And I'm going to say one more thing, and Carolyn, thank you for letting me talk. A lot of my guests don't let me talk.
Oh, no, absolutely. That's how you and I do it all the time. I mean, it's wonderful to hear what you've got to say. So, and I'm fascinated that you actually had met Skinner. You know, you read about all these people, and so it's fascinating that you've actually met him. And, it's so dangerous what he actually proposed with behaviorism. I actually write about that in one of my books as well, and it's just very good that you've highlighted that. You know, it took away our humanity, and that's what's happening today with the current medical model. You know, the psychiatric model is dehumanizing people. You know, we've got to look back at our human element.
There's always been these destructive models. I wanted to say one other thing that I'm not sure if I've ever talked about this much in public, but I was reading about quantum physics as a freshman or sophomore at Harvard. took a great course on the history of science, which was just so influential in opening my eyes that science is people and history. The professor's name was Cohen. I'm sure he's gone now. And I got so interested in the quantum physics concept of indeterminacy, that is, that you can't really determine the position of an electron in space at any one particular moment because you're very observing of it, shines light on it, and electrons on it, and it gets very impossible, and that all of this leads theoretically to the concept that that we can't actually predict, that a lot of life is probability. And I remember going all the way back to that, Einstein not agreeing with that and saying, no, God does. He literally said God doesn't play dice with the universe. And I actually wrote a paper saying that I thought that this new quantum physics that we were learning about promoted free will. And I got hosed by my teaching assistant for writing that, as I didn't know what I was talking about. I think I told you about this. And so I've been leery, and I've been leery about making some of these connections that Carolyn's making, Deepak Chopra and other people have worked on over the years. But I'm there. I think it's time that we just open our minds and our imaginations and start looking at just how much mind affects everything about us, mind and spirit. Let me give it back to you now, Carolyn.
Well, I love what you just said, and I think what's vital in what you've just said is a key component is that what we, as someone who believes in God and believes that God is the source of all love and love is keeps the world going round, to sound very, the cliched statement, I find it very interesting that what you instinctively know can be scientifically proven. So to know that the spiritual and the science are so compatible is a very important for me as in the work that I do. And so I don't know if you've heard in terms of related to quantum physics and so on, there is Sir Roger Penrose, who is a mathematician, probably one of the greatest mathematicians of the century. He actually has, and I'm going to summarize, I mean, I don't fully understand his mathematics because it's not my field, but what I do understand is his applications and his work. He works with another brilliant scientist called Hammerhoff in Arizona. And basically what Penrose has shown is that you can mathematically show that the space-time dimension of the universe, Einstein's basic work, is embedded in values of love. And then us as humans, humanity, as we are operating in love, then we are accessing this humanity, this normal state of humanity, which is that we're immersed in love. And he's actually done the mathematics for it. He's proposed this on a quantum and mathematical level. So you hear these things like love and you think that that's one thing. And then you hear mathematics and you think it's another thing. And then you hear quantum physics and the way it's being presented, people are often very wary of it. Meanwhile, it's so accurately proven. As I said, it's considered to be one of the most accurate of sciences. And you see that there's such a crossover between spirituality and science, between that love actually has these mathematical coordinates in space-time, which is just the start of a whole new field of research, which makes it something that's a bit more tangible and real for us as humans when people are in a bad place. I have found when I'm helping people that are in a bad place emotionally or have been so over-therapeutized or for years have been battling with a traumatic brain injury and or years of bullying or years of battling with learning or something, they've got such a poor self-esteem that to be able to tell them that, you know, that's not who you are, that's who you've become, that you have the power to literally rewire your brain and that there's science behind it. That you can actually change this, and that these great scientists and great philosophers that are showing us that this is the way. I found it's really helped the people that I've worked with to give them that scientific thing to hang on to. And I found from all my work with the different fields that I work in, because I initially did a BSc in logopedics, so we had a nice introduction to all these concepts as well when I was studying, that it's really helped me to come closer to understanding the power of the mind. And I see the mind in a very scientific angle, and that's fairly unusual, but for a while people have been seeing, and you kind of picked up on that in your statement earlier on, that for a long time people have seen quantum physics and mind as being out there and science as being another thing. But those worlds have crossed over. And daily there's studies pouring out showing the impact of the mind on the brain and the body. You know, up to seven, some of the research in oncology, for example, shows that 98% of cancer is coming from the mind, from the thought life. You know, and if you look at the quantum neurobiology, which is very interesting.
Looking at that's a huge leap. Now, wait a second. It's a huge leap.
One step at a time.
That almost all of cancer is related to the thought process. You got to stop on that and talk to us.
I know,
about
that's
that.
A big one. That's a big one.
Yes,
so what
a big
they're
one,
saying.
Carolyn.
Okay,
go
so
ahead.
The general, and I have in my books, I have a huge body of scientific references for this. But there is basically what the oncology research, cancer research is saying, that there is a massive relationship between the mind and cancer. And the basic thing, cancer is with cells, too many cells that are forming in the body, so they overtake the natural cells. So it's a too many cells. That's a very simple way of explaining it. And if you look at cell division, there's certain structures that are involved, and I'm going to take an incredibly complex subject and try and make it as simple as I can. But when cells divide, there's structures in the cell that are involved directly in cell division, and they're called microtubules. And microtubules are made of things called tubulin, which is a very, very specific type of protein. And what a lot of what quantum neurobiology research is showing is that those tubulin are very involved in thinking and actual memory formation. And in my latest book that is about to be released in September, I write a lot about this. And it's called Think, Learn, Succeed. And what that tubulin does is that as you're thinking, if you think in the correct way, then the tubulin folds in the correct way and the microtubules do what they're supposed to do. And the cell division happens like it should happen. And your body does what it's supposed to do because your body's constantly is constantly reproducing cells, as we all know. So essentially, if you take it now in the reverse direction, which is where this research is going, if you think a toxic thought, so if you think, and I just label things toxic thinking to cover a broad range, it's an umbrella term really for thinking in any kind of toxic way, so envy, jealousy, worry, bitterness, rumination, not dealing with the past, not forgiving, anything that will keep us in a bad place. That kind of thinking is an electromagnetic, it's going to generate an electromagnetic force through the brain because your mind works through the substrate of your brain. You're going to have quantum energy action in the brain because it's energy and it generates, your thinking generates energy. And right down to the level of these little tiny proteins inside the tubulin, inside the cells, are affected, so our cell division is affected. So the proposed theory, and it's still very new, is that as you think incorrectly, you are damaging the way that cell division is occurring. And this is potentially a link showing how our thought life is directly involved in a lot of disease, like cancer, like Alzheimer's, and these kind of things. In fact, a lot of this research is showing that 75 to 98%, which is a huge percentage, of diseases that are starting to track back to the way we're thinking, lifestyle, choices, mind, how we're managing our mind and how that's actually impacting our body.
Well, you put a lot of different things together there. And wow, this is going to be so interesting to, and you're going to hear more from Carolyn, folks. And again, her name's Carolyn Leaf, L-E-A-F. And the one thing that is very getting clearer to me is the importance of lifestyle, the importance of what we eat and how we carry ourselves and how we stand and how we walk and everything about, you know, how we handle ourselves physically in this universe affects our whole bodies and affects our minds and makes for a package. So, you know, I'm 81 years old. There's a conclusion that comes from those 81 years. These intricacies, which sound very speculative to me, that Carolyn is talking about with us, I think are very, very interesting. And I do think it's time for us to open our minds more and more to this. And we need to do it because it also gives a lot of hope to people that we're thinking in terms of our minds changing us for the better when what we've been taught is it's our brains ruining our minds. And yes. I think that Carolyn's reversal of that is extraordinarily important. And I look forward to learning more and more about it and winnowing it out for my own self. But I'm very, very much with what you're doing, Caroline, what you're thinking about, and this just reversing the whole inquiry and reversing the speculation in the direction of how our minds, including direct action of thought, as Caroline is saying, and certainly how our thoughts change our lifestyle and how we're feeling and how our gut is, even how our gut and our hearts and so on are operating from second to second. I mean, that's just absolutely clear. I mean, I can tell you that me at 81 dealing with stress and its effects on my body are really different than me at 35, 45, 55, or even 65, that we can learn more and more to make ourselves the way we want to be and to do it not just alone, but through loving relationships and family and nature and God and all the resources there are out there for us. Well, Caroline, this is a different kind of show, and it'll be, I hope, inspiring to people to begin to open their minds and especially to reverse the direction in which we're being pushed to put our thinking and our hopes and our speculations and our hard science in the direction of how mind and spirit affect our bodies and the physical universe, living matter, and also then what we do to change the universe, because we do that as human beings. We are not at the mercy of the physical universe, the brain. And in some ways, unfortunately, the physical universe is more at our mercy than we are at its mercy often. Golly, how are you doing there, Karen?
Oh, I'm doing so well, and I'm just so excited to be able to, you know, to be able to help people to actually see that there's, you know, even if you don't understand all the science, what is exciting is that there is, you know, there's the story of, you know, I think maybe the easiest way to explain it is that the word science comes from the word sclera, which means knowledge. So as we gain more knowledge, we're going to be changing the way we function. And, you know, science is always about 20 years ahead of what we are exposed to in the media and in education. So what's actually happening in terms of our lifestyles and how we run our lives on a day-to-day basis is always around about 20 years behind science. And, you know, if I look back at what I've been doing for the last 25 years, the things I was saying, this stuff, when I said this 25 years ago, I was told that, you know, I'm crazy. But when I showed it, as soon as you show it scientifically, use a scientific method, I would work with people with damage in their brains, literally that were written off as vegetables, some of them. I mean, that's how bad the neurology, how the neurologists used to speak about them, and who came back to full functioning and, in fact, went on to get genius IQs. And it's not just once that I saw this, you know, working in the schools. You know, it's all science-y, the stuff I'm talking about, but my career has been predominantly paralleled with a very practical application with my private practice and my clinical work, and I trained thousands of teachers in education and then worked for years, 25 years, 3 days a week in impoverished areas in South Africa. And I can tell you, I saw when you don't have anything except your mind, you've literally got no food, you've literally got no shelter, you've got nothing except your spirit, your will, your drive, your passion. And you tell someone like that that you actually can change your circumstances, and you see people. I mean, Peter, if I may just share one story about a young man, is that okay? Do we have time for me to share a quick story that kind of summarizes everything, why I'm so driven to do what I do?
Take five or six minutes to tell the story.
Okay, so we've got I used to spend a lot of time working in the apartheid era, just prior to when Mandela was made president in 1994, and then it was the post-apartheid era. So I grew up in the apartheid era and fought that and was very anti that whole situation. And, you know, I made it a conscious effort. My husband and I both worked in those environments. I worked in education and mind health, mental health, and my husband actually used to build houses for people that were literally living on the street. And both of us used to go into the most dangerous areas of South Africa with white people did not come out alive, and obviously we came out alive. But it was, and I say that not to think that we're heroes, but to say that when you go with a message of hope and you operate in love, you change your environment. People look at you differently. People will hear your message when you operate in love. And there was a distinct acceptance. I could go anywhere. I was 9 months pregnant, and I'd be driving through these areas, and people would be flocking in their thousands to come and squash into areas, into broken down halls and things just to hear how your mind works and how memory works and how you can learn. And it was the most uplifting experience. And one day I was working with a group of kids and young, it was teachers and students in the school. And I mean, when I say school, these are places where you have one textbook, 100 kids to 100 kids, a broken old chalkboard, the black chalkboards with broken bits of chalk. And like the teachers had to write the information up on the walls on newsprint so that the children could actually have some knowledge to learn from. Most of them hadn't eaten for days. Most of them had a story that would break your heart. Most of them were AIDS victims, abused, raped at least once in their life, or if not multiple times. And this is the kind of environment when you see this level of and depth of human trauma and being treated in such a dehumanized way, you come into that the message of hope, and they're so hopeful and they respond to you. It's absolutely humbling. And one day I was teaching this A group, and a young man walked in, and he had dreadlocks, and he was tall and strong and the strapping young man. And as he walked into this big room, everyone just moved. It literally parted like the Dead Sea. You know, it was just literally moving. And he moved to the back of the room. And I felt that, you know, he stared such hate towards me that I thought, boy, I'm not going to leave here without an escort today because this guy's got it in for me. You know, it was immediately what went through my head. And I thought, well, I'm going to carry on teaching because there's quite a few hundred people here that have come to hear what I've got to say. So I'm not going to stop. And I just carried on. And as the day went by, I could feel his attitude softening towards me. And, you know, when you say feel attitude, that's really quantum physics. His anger towards me initially started shifting and his mind changed, his mindset changed. So his brain changed as he was listening to what I was telling him. So he started going from a state of anger towards me towards one of acceptance. And I felt that at the end of the day, after about 5 hours, and these people would sit, Peter, for 5 to 6 to 8 hours without moving. They would literally not move. A lot of them hadn't eaten. I mean, most people today, they can't sit still for 10 minutes and they want to go and have a break or something like that. They would sit for 5, 6, 7, 8 hours. Anyway, at the end of the day, this young man, the teacher said, who would like to thank Dr. Lee for, you know, teaching us about our mind and our brain and learning and whatever. And this young man ran up to the front of the classroom, tears pouring down his eyes, and he was holding up a pen, and he said, Dr. Leaf, now I know what to do with my pen. It turned out that he was the local pimp, the local drug dealer. Everyone was petrified of him because he was very scary, involved with all the worst gangs. But he had such a desire to learn, so he would still come to school. And he was in his early 20s, and he would just turn up at school from time to time. Very intelligent young man. Anyway, he transformed his life, transformed his community, stopped doing what he was doing. And, you know, it's those kind of stories, and these I have thousands of those kind of stories that made me realize that when you show someone the power of their mind, and you can, and they immediately see the impact they can have on their own lives and their community, because it's not just about me, myself, and I, it's about all of us. It's about changing community and using what you've got to change the world.
Thank you, Carolyn Leaf. The music is on. Folks, I hope you've been inspired. You're going to learn more about her as the year goes on. And I wish all of you a great and wonderful day, whether you're listening to this today or 5 years from now on an archive. Keep coming back. Keep listening. Keep growing. And we are on the move, folks. We're on the move. And thank you, PRN-FM. Thank you, PRN-FM. Good night, folks. Bye-bye now.